The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. The broadcast this week will focus on articles about coffee. The first one was published in the July 30th, 2001 edition of the New Yorker magazine in the critics section, Java Man, How Caffeine Created the Modern World by Malcolm Gladwell. The original Coca-Cola was a late 19th century concoction known as Pemberton's French Wine Coca, a mixture of alcohol, the caffeine-rich cola nut, and coca, the raw ingredient of cocaine. In the face of social pressure, first the wine and then the coca were removed, leaving the more banal modern beverage in its place, carbonated, caffeinated sugar water with less kick to it than a cup of coffee. But is that the way we think of Coke? Not at all. In the 1930s, a commercial artist named Haddon Sunbloom had the bright idea of posing a portly retired friend of his in a red Santa Claus suit with a Coke in his hand and plastering the image on billboards and advertisements across the country. Coke magically was reborn as caffeine for children, caffeine without any of the weighty adult connotations of coffee and tea. It was, as the ads with Sunbloom's Santa put it, the pause that refreshes. It added life. It could teach the world to sing. One of the things that have always made drugs so powerful is their cultural adaptability, their way of acquiring meanings beyond their pharmacology. We think of marijuana, for example, as a drug of lethargy, of disaffection. But in Colombia, the historian David T. Courtwright points out in Forces of Habit, published by Harvard, peasants boast that cannabis helps them to quite la cansancio, or reduce fatigue, increase their fuerza and ánimo, force and spirit, and become incansable, tireless. In Germany, right after the Second World War, cigarettes briefly and suddenly became the equivalent of crack cocaine. Up to a point, the majority of the habitual smokers preferred to do without food, even under extreme conditions of nutrition, rather than to forego tobacco, according to one account of the period. Many housewives bartered fat and sugar for cigarettes. Even a drug as demonized as opium has been seen in a more favorable light. In the 1830s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather, Warren Delano II, made the family fortune exporting the drug to China. And Delano was able to sugarcoat his activities so plausibly that no one ever accused his grandson of being the scion of a drug lord. And yet, as Bennett Allen Weinberg and Bonnie K. Beeler remind us in their marvelous new book, The World of Caffeine, published by Routledge, there is no drug quite as effortlessly adaptable as caffeine, the zealot of chemical stimulants. At one moment, in one form, it is the drug of choice of cafe intellectuals and artists, in another of housewives, in another of Zen monks, and in yet another of children enthralled by a fat man who slides down chimneys. King Gustav III, who ruled Sweden in the latter half of the 18th century, was so convinced of the particular perils of coffee over all other forms of caffeine that he devised an elaborate experiment. A convicted murderer was sentenced to drink cup after cup of coffee until he died, with another murderer sentenced to a lifetime of tea drinking as a control. Unfortunately, the two doctors in charge of the study died before anyone else did. Then Gustav was murdered, and finally the tea drinker died at 83 of old age, leaving the original murderer alone with his espresso and leaving coffee's supposed toxicity in some doubt. Later, the various forms of caffeine began to be divided up along sociological lines. Wolfgang Schwibbelbusch, in his book Tastes of Paradise, argues that in the 18th century, coffee symbolized the rising middle classes, whereas its great caffeinated rival in those years, cocoa, or as it was known at the time, chocolate, was the drink of the aristocracy. Goethe, who used art as a means to lift himself out of his middle-class background into the aristocracy, and who, as a member of a courtly society, maintained a sense of aristocratic calm, even in the midst of immense productivity, made a cult of chocolate and avoided coffee, Schwivelbusch writes. Balzac, who, despite his sentimental allegiance to the monarchy, lived and labored for the literary marketplace and for it alone, became one of the most excessive coffee drinkers in history. Here, we see two fundamentally different working styles and means of stimulation, fundamentally different psychologies and physiologies. Today, of course, the chief cultural distinction is between coffee and tea, which, according to a list drawn up by Weinberg and Beeler, have come to represent almost entirely opposite sensibilities. That the American Revolution began with a symbolic rejection of tea in Boston Harbor, in other words, makes perfect sense. Real revolutionaries would naturally prefer coffee. By contrast, the freedom fighters of Canada, 100 years later, were most definitely tea drinkers. And where was Canada's autonomy won? Not on the blood-soaked fields of Lexington and Concord, but in the genteel drawing rooms of Westminster, over a nice cup of Darjeeling and a small triangular cucumber sandwiches. All of this is a bit puzzling. We don't fetishize the difference between salmon eaters and tuna eaters, or people who like their eggs sunny side up and those who like them scrambled. So why invest so much importance in the way people prefer their caffeine? A cup of coffee has somewhere between 100 and 250 milligrams. Black tea, brewed for 4 minutes, has between 40 and 100 milligrams. But the disparity disappears if you consider that many tea drinkers drink from a pot and have more than one cup. Caffeine is caffeine. The more it is pondered, Weinberg and Beeler write, the more paradoxical this duality within the culture of caffeine appears. After all, both coffee and tea are aromatic infusions of vegetable matter, served hot or cold in similar quantities. Both are often mixed with cream or sugar. Both are universally available in virtually any grocery or restaurant in civilized society, and both contain the identical psychoactive alkaloid stimulant, caffeine. It would seem to make more sense to draw distinctions based on the way caffeine is metabolized rather than the way it is served. Caffeine, whether it is in coffee or tea or a soft drink, moves easily from the stomach and intestines into the bloodstream and from there to the organs, and before long has penetrated almost every cell of the body. This is the reason that caffeine is such a wonderful stimulant. Most substances can't cross the blood-brain barrier, which is the body's defensive mechanism, preventing viruses or toxins from entering the central nervous system. Caffeine does so easily. Within an hour or so, it reaches its peak concentration in the brain, and there it does a number of things, principally blocking the action of adenosine, the neuromodulator that makes you sleepy, lowers your blood pressure, and slows down your heartbeat. Then, as quickly as it builds up in your brain and tissues, caffeine is gone, which is why it's so safe. Caffeine in ordinary quantities has never been conclusively linked to serious illnesses. But how quickly it washes away differs dramatically from person to person. A 200-pound man who drinks a cup of coffee with 100 milligrams of caffeine will have a maximum caffeine concentration of 1 milligram per kilogram of body weight. A 100-pound woman having the same cup of coffee will reach a caffeine concentration of 2 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, or twice as high. In addition, when women are on the pill, the rate at which they clear caffeine from their bodies slows considerably. Some of the side effects experienced by women on the pill may, in fact, be caffeine jitters caused by their sudden inability to tolerate as much coffee as they could before. Pregnancy reduces a woman's ability to process caffeine still further. The half-life of caffeine in an adult is roughly 3.5 hours. In a pregnant woman, it's 18 hours. Even a 4-month-old child processes caffeine more efficiently. An average man and woman sitting down for a cup of coffee are thus not pharmaceutical equals. In effect, the woman is under the influence of a vastly more powerful drug. Given these differences, you'd think that, instead of contrasting the caffeine cultures of tea and coffee, we'd contrast the caffeine cultures of men and women. But we don't, and with good reason. To parse caffeine among gender lines does not do justice to its capacity to insinuate itself into every aspect of our lives, not merely to influence culture, but even to create it. Take coffee's reputation as the thinker's drink. This dates from 18th century Europe, where coffee houses played a major role in the egalitarian, inclusionary spirit that was then sweeping the continent. They sprang up first in London, so alarming Charles II that in 1676 he tried to ban them. It didn't work. By 1700, there were hundreds of coffee houses in London, their subversive spirit best captured by a couplet from a comedy of the period. In a coffee house just now among the rabble, I bluntly ask, which is the treason table? The movement then spread to Paris, and by the end of the 18th century, coffee houses numbered in the hundreds, most famously the Café de la Régence near the Palais Royal, which counted among its customers Robespierre, Napoleon, Voltaire, Victor Hugo, Théophile Gautier, Rousseau, and the Duke of Richelieu. Previously, when men had gathered together to talk in public places, they had done so in bars, which drew from specific socioeconomic niches and, because of the alcohol they served, created a specific kind of talk. The new coffee houses, by contrast, drew from many different classes and trades, and they served a stimulant, not a depressant. It is not extravagant to claim that it was in these gathering spots that the art of conversation became the basis of a new literary style and that a new ideal of general education in letters was born, wrote Weinberg and Beeler. It is worth noting as well that in the original coffee houses, nearly everyone smoked, and nicotine also has a distinctive physiological effect. It moderates mood and extends attention, and more important, it doubles the rate of caffeine metabolism. It allows you to drink twice as much coffee as you could otherwise. In other words, the original coffee house was a place where men of all types could sit all day. The tobacco they smoked made it possible to drink coffee all day, and the coffee they drank inspired them to talk all day. Out of this came the Enlightenment. The next time we so perfectly married pharmacology and place, we got Joan Baez. In time, caffeine moved from the cafe to the home. In America, coffee triumphed because of the country's proximity to the new Caribbean and Latin American coffee plantations and the fact that throughout the 19th century, duties were negligible. Beginning in the 1820s, Courtright tells us, Brazil unleashed a flood of slave-produced coffee. American per capita consumption, 3 pounds per year in 1830, rose to 8 pounds by 1859. What this flood of caffeine did, according to Weinberg and Beeler, was to abet the process of industrialization, to help large numbers of people to coordinate their work schedules by giving them the energy to start work at a given time and continue it as long as necessary. Until the 18th century, it must be remembered, many Westerners drank beer almost continuously, even beginning their day with something called beer soup. Beeler and Weinberg helpfully provide the following 18th century German recipe. Heat the beer in a saucepan. In a separate small pot, beat a couple of eggs. Add a chunk of butter to the hot beer, stir in some cool beer to cool it, and then pour over the eggs. Add a bit of salt, and finally mix all the ingredients together, whisking it well to keep it from curdling. Now they begin each day with a strong cup of coffee. One way to explain the Industrial Revolution is as the inevitable consequence of a world where people suddenly preferred being jittery to being drunk. In the modern world, there was no other way to keep up. That's what Edison meant when he said that genius was 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. In the old paradigm, working with your mind had been associated with leisure. It was only the poor who worked hard. The quintessential pre-industrial narrative of inspiration belonged to Archimedes, who made his discovery, let's not forget, while taking a bath. But Edison was saying that the old class distinctions no longer held true, that in the industrialized world there was as much toil associated with the life of the mind as there had once been with the travails of the body. In the 20th century, the professions transformed themselves accordingly. Medicine turned the residency process into an ordeal of sleeplessness. The legal profession borrowed a page from the manufacturing floor and made its practitioners fill out time cards like union men. Intellectual heroics became a matter of endurance. The pace of computation was hectic, James Gleick writes of the Manhattan Project in Genius, his biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. Feynman's day began at 8:30 and ended 15 hours later. Sometimes he could not leave the computing center at all. He worked through the 31 hours once, and the next day found that an error minutes after he went to bed had stalled the whole team. The routine allowed just a few breaks. Did Feynman's achievement reflect a greater natural talent than his less productive forebears had, or did he just drink a lot more coffee? Paul Hoffman, in The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, writes of the legendary 20th century mathematician Paul Erdős that, quote, he put in 19-hour days, keeping himself fortified with 10 to 20 milligrams of Benzedrine or Ritalin, strong espresso, and caffeine tablets. A mathematician, Erdős was fond of saying, is a machine for turning coffee into theorems. Once, a friend bet Erdős $500 that he could not quit amphetamines for a month. Erdős took the bet and won, but during his time of abstinence, he found himself incapable of doing any serious work. You've set mathematics back a month, he told his friend when he collected and immediately returned to his pills. Erdős's unadulterated self was less real and less familiar to him than his adulterated self, and that is a condition that holds, more or less, for the rest of society as well. Part of what it means to be human in the modern age is that we have come to construct our emotional and cognitive states not merely from the inside out, with thought and intention, but from the outside in, with chemical additives. The modern personality is, in this sense, a synthetic creation, skillfully regulated and medicated and dosed with caffeine so that we can always be awake and alert and focused when we need to be. On a bet, no doubt, we could walk away from caffeine if we had to. But what would be the point? The lawyers wouldn't make their billable hours. The young doctors would fall behind in their training. The physicists might still be stuck out in New Mexico desert. We'd set the world back a month. That the modern personality is synthetic is, of course, a disquieting notion. When we talk of synthetic personality or of constructing new selves through chemical means, we think of hard drugs, not caffeine. Timothy Leary used to make such claims about LSD, and the reason his revolution never took flight was that most of us found the concept of tuning in, turning on, and dropping out to be a bit creepy. Here was this shaman, this visionary, and yet, if his consciousness was so great, why was he so intent on altering it? More important, what exactly were we supposed to be tuning into? We were given hints with psychedelic colors and deep readings of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, but that was never enough. If we are to recreate ourselves, we would like to know what we will become. Caffeine is the best and most useful of our drugs because in every one of its forms it can answer that question precisely. It is a stimulant that blocks the action of adenosine and comes in a multitude of guises, each with a ready-made story attached. A mixture of history and superstition and whimsy, which infuses the daily ritual of adenosine blocking with meaning and purpose. Put caffeine in a red can and it becomes refreshing fun. Brew it in a teapot and it becomes romantic and decorous. Extract it from little brown beans and magically it is hard-headed and potent. There was a little-known Russian emigre, Trotsky by name, who during World War I was in the habit of playing chess in Vienna's Café Central every evening. Wieler and Wyburn write in one of the book's many fascinating café yarns. This is what they wrote. A typical Russian refugee who talked too much but seemed utterly harmless, indeed a pathetic figure in the eyes of the Viennese. One day in 1917, an official of the Austrian Foreign Ministry rushed into the minister's room, panting and excited, and told his chief, your Excellency, revolution has broken out in Russia. The minister, less excitable and less credulous than his official, rejected such a wild claim and retorted calmly, go away. Russia is not a land where revolutions break out. Besides, who on earth would make a revolution in Russia? Perhaps Mr. Trotsky from the Café Central? The minister should have known better. Give a man enough coffee and he's capable of anything. Next, from the November 13, 2011 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Sacred Grounds by Khalifa Saneh. Ada Battelle is a fifth-generation coffee farmer and a first-generation coffee celebrity. On the steep hillsides of Santa Ana Volcano in western El Salvador, she produces beans that trade on the extreme end of the coffee market, where a 12-ounce bag may cost $20 or more and comes accompanied by a lyrical essay on provenance and flavor. These beans have made Battelle an object of obsession among coffee connoisseurs and professionals, the coffee equivalent of a European vigneron. And she is willing to play the role if it helps raise coffee's status. Talking about coffee makes her happy. Even her complaints are enthusiastic. There are hundreds of Cabernets, and that's okay, she says. Coffee should be the same way. They all taste different. In a small but growing number of cafes, you can order coffee more or less the way you might order wine, specifying the varietal and the region and the farm. For the price of a glass of a house red, you will receive, if you're lucky, a cup of drip coffee that is mellower and weirder than the astringent beverage most people know. Perhaps you will detect a hint of gingerbread, or a honeyed aftertaste, or a rich, tangy sweetness that calls to mind tomato soup. And perhaps you will find it difficult to go back to whatever you used to drink. During the Salvadorian Civil War, which lasted from 1980 until 1992, the Battelle family took refuge in Miami, which is where Ada Battelle grew up. After trying and forsaking college, she settled with her husband in Nashville. And sometime after her marriage fell apart, she realized she had no good reason to stay there. She was 28, managing a restaurant and catering company, and she thought she might be more useful in El Salvador. Her father, Mauricio, was struggling. The price of coffee had reached a record low, and he was losing money with every harvest. She arrived in Santa Ana, the country's scruffy second city, in 2002, only vaguely acquainted with the business and practice of coffee farming. She knew that the family land had potential because of its high altitude and rich volcanic soil. And although she had never actually drunk a cup of Battelle coffee, that wasn't unusual, there was no such thing, her father sold his crop to the local mill, which mixed it with crops from nearby farms and exported the product as a generic Salvadoran coffee blend. He gave his daughter control, assuming that no matter what she did, the mill would still purchase whatever the farms produced. Coffee is a fruit. The beans are seeds that develop in pairs within the gumball-sized cherry. Battelle's idea was to treat her coffee the same way her local Wild Oats supermarket in Nashville had treated fruit. She would grow the plants organically and pick only cherry, coffee people never pluralized cherry, that was ripe and healthy looking, the one she would want to eat. During harvest, she often snacks on coffee cherry, which has a mild watermelon-like sweetness and some caffeine. Because she was a novice and a woman, she faced no small amount of skepticism from her farm managers. More than one worker responded to her request by asking, "Where's your father?" Eventually, they realized that her requests were directives. At one point, she threatened to fire a farm manager unless he agreed to send his kids to school. Battelle occasionally startled the cherry pickers by diving in alongside them to show them what she wanted done and, to a lesser extent, to help. She is an accurate picker, but not a quick one. Although Battelle didn't quite realize it, her approach to coffee farming was deeply peculiar. She was coddling a crop that has, for centuries, been subjugated to rough treatment. Why worry about the succulence of the cherry if all you really care about is the pit? But she arrived in El Salvador just as a new international coffee movement drawn to beans and stories like hers was cresting. For much of the 20th century, coffee was marketed under brand names that promised reliabilities. Consumers knew that their next cup of Folgers, or for that matter, their next cup of Starbucks, would taste just like last month's or last year's. By the late 1990s, more roasters were de-emphasizing blended coffee in order to highlight the singular virtues of their favorite beans. In 1999, a cohort of coffee professionals created the Cup of Excellence, a series of national competitions designed to identify and reward exceptional farmers. Experts would conduct a blind coffee taste test, known as a cupping, and the winning beans would be sold through an online auction. El Salvador's inaugural Cup of Excellence competition was held in 2003, and Battelle decided to enter. Coffee from Finca Kilimanjaro, one of her farms, impressed a panel of judges, which included Jeff Watts of Intelligentsia Coffee, the influential Chicago-based roaster and cafe operator. Central American coffees tend to taste rich and chocolatey. Kilimanjaro had some of the rich sweetness that judges expected, but it also had what professionals called brightness, a tart, fruity flavor more commonly associated with Kenyan coffee. Battelle was relieved to discover that she liked her own product, even though she didn't know why. "I knew I was tasting something, but my brain could not identify it," she says. Kilimanjaro won the competition, and at auction, a Norwegian roaster paid $14.06 a pound for it, a record at the time. The open market price was less than a dollar a pound. The auction earned Battelle almost $40,000, which helped her convince her father that there were eager buyers for coddled coffee. More importantly, the publicity introduced Battelle to the coffee buyers she calls the Dream Team. Peter Giuliano, the scholarly co-owner of an idealistic North Carolina company called Counterculture Coffee, Thompson Owen, the mad scientist behind Sweet Maria's in Oakland, and Dwayne Sorensen, the pugnacious founder of Stumptown in Portland, Oregon. All of them understood Battelle's conscientious farming, and they were willing to pay enough to allow her to keep at it. She had stumbled upon a community of people who cared almost as much about her farms as she did. One warm morning this summer, Battelle drove up the side of the volcano in her off-road vehicle, a Toyota FJ Cruiser, to check on her farms. For most of the 20th century, El Salvador was one of the biggest coffee producers in the world. But the Salvadoran coffee business still hasn't recovered from the Civil War, and today El Salvador exports less than half as much coffee as it did in 1975. In this diminished industry, Battelle is a visible symbol of rebirth, although the visibility comes at a cost. El Salvador is smaller than Massachusetts, with about as many people, and it has one of the world's highest rates of violent crime. So Battelle travels with at least three companions, two armed guards and one extraordinarily well-trained German shepherd, Chief, who seems to be up saving up all his barking for a sufficiently critical situation. On that morning, though, crime presented a less immediate danger than the washed-out dirt road. Back when coffee ruled El Salvador, my great-grandfather used to be able to drive up here in a Buick, Battelle said. She now requires not just her FJ Cruiser with its row of four-wheel drive controls, she calls him her magic buttons, but also a pair of black Harley-Davidson gloves so that she doesn't get blisters from squeezing the steering wheel. It is possible to grow coffee near sea level, just not very good coffee. The rigors of elevation, lower oxygen levels, colder nights, force the plants to grow more slowly, creating harder, denser beans that produce the vibrant, slightly acidic flavors that are generally considered indispensable to a great cup. It was June, a month or two after harvest, and the farms bore few obvious signs of agricultural enterprise. Waist-high coffee plants with vine-like branches grew in no discernible pattern. They covered a hillside so sheer that pickers sometimes had to be lowered on ropes. Battelle Pacer pickers 8 cents a pound, more than twice the going rate, because her exacting standards mean that everything takes longer. Tall fruit trees, Jocotes de Corona and Pepetos Peludos, provide shade, which retards the ripening of the coffee cherry and intensifies the flavor of the beans. In some areas, sturdy Capulchi trees form a wind curtain, letting breezes through but protecting the plants from damage. As Battelle's truck arrived at a small farmhouse, the farm manager appeared, a lanky man in a camouflage Superman t-shirt with two machetes hanging at his back. The coffee plant is native to the part of Africa that is now Ethiopia. By the 15th century, traders and thieves were planting it farther afield. It spread throughout the Arab world to India, to Southeast Asia, and largely through a French colonial officer in the early 1700s to the Caribbean and the Americas. In El Salvador, the small farmers, much romanticized by coffee fanatics, are often small landlords, some of whom don't have much interest in agronomy. But Battelle's managers have grown accustomed to her daily visits and detailed questions. Perhaps she didn't seem intimidating at first. She is a small, friendly woman who wears jeans and a t-shirt whenever possible, and she has a shy smile, although her shyness dissolves whenever talk turns to coffee, as it always does, often at her instigation. She hates public speaking, but she excels at chatting up strangers, many of whom find themselves peering at photographs of coffee plants on her iPhone. Battelle's farms are dominated by a temperamental but fertile cultivar called Bourbon, pronounced Bourbon, a member of the Arabica species named for the Indian Ocean island of Réunion, formerly known as Bourbon, where it thrived. Bourbon came to El Salvador more than 100 years ago, acquired from Guatemala by the governor of Santa Ana province, Narciso Aviles, Battelle's great-great-grandfather. She waded into a copse where spindly Bourbon plants grew alongside a newer hybrid, Pacamara. Battelle's heterogeneous inventory is partly a result of El Salvador's complicated history. Civil war interrupted the national coffee industry at a time when other Central American countries were replacing their Bourbon plants with hardier hybrids. As a result, in El Salvador, more of the old varieties survived. To me, these Bourbons have always been ballerinas, tall, elegant, Battelle said fondly. These pacas are more like gymnasts, short and stubby. As she left one farm, she called the manager over and pointed to some Bourbon shoots. "Treat them with love and kindness, please," she said. In order to have her coffee certified organic, Battelle must pay for annual inspections, which often lead to further expenditures. One year, the inspector noticed that a neighbor had cows, and Battelle had to erect fences to keep the non-organic cows and their non-organic dung away from her plants. Because she can't use chemical herbicides, she is always looking for organic alternatives. "I tried the natural one, made from clove oil and cinnamon oil. It's called Weed Zap," she says, shaking her head. "Nothing. The weeds were like, hey, thanks for this." At Finca Kilimanjaro, where workers were digging small holes to replant one slope with juvenile Bourbon plants, she spied a white speck in the dirt, picked it up, and summoned an overseer. "La gallina ciega," she said. She was holding in her palm a tiny beetle larva curled up into a ball. "They eat the roots," she said. "They're horrible." Coffee plants also manufacture their own pesticide, a chemical that is toxic to some small organisms and mildly intoxicating to larger ones. For many coffee drinkers, that chemical, caffeine, is all that matters. Their beverage, in its humblest incarnation, is little more than a pesticide delivery system. As Battelle drove higher up the hill, blasting M&M, the climate shifted. at 5,300 feet, which is about as high as coffee will flourish. The air was cool, and leafy bushes had given way to spindly cypress trees. The truck came to a stop on a neat lawn next to a house that looked out over the valley to Santa Ana and beyond. This was Los Alpas, the family's highest altitude farm. Next to the main house was a rectangular patch surrounded by the remains of concrete walls. It had been one of the family houses, and it was burned down during the Civil War. Battelle experienced the violence of the 80s only indirectly through the brutal and surreal things she saw during her occasional visits to El Salvador. "It sounds bad," she said, "but you get used to seeing dead bodies by the side of the road." Battelle has been back in El Salvador for almost a decade now, but she lives like an expatriate. When she talks about home, she often means Miami. In Santa Ana, she doesn't drink the water, and she keeps her distance from the roadside vendors selling pupusas and corn on the cob. She almost never goes to San Salvador, except for meetings or flights. "I do need to have more of a personal life," she says, "but my promise is I don't miss it." Her passions include the rapper Flo Rida and the video game Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which she plays online using a screen name one of her nephews came up with, Coffee Rockstar. As she toured her farms, Battelle was distracted by a series of emails and phone calls. Her father had died a few weeks before. Mauricio Battelle had been 72. There were lawyers and documents that needed Battelle's attention and decisions that only she could make. She had learned her father's business just in time to succeed him. Back in town, inside a family compound ringed by a 15-foot-high wall, Battelle showed off the small office that she had shared with him. The room was dominated by his desk and was full of mementos, including a hand-drawn map of the family farms from 1938. On a small table in one corner, there were nearly 50 bags of her coffee from roasters around the world, most accompanied by testimonials. From a 2008 Stumptown offering, Ida battles relentless focus on picking perfectly ripe cherry during the harvest, and her flawless processing are virtually unmatched and evident in the cup. When she first saw that blurb, she dispatched a friendly email to Stumptown, both to say thanks and to point out politely that someone had misspelled her last name. Most coffee farmers don't fact-check their clients' promotional material, but these clients are Battelle's peers and her closest friends. Her success has to do with culture as well as agriculture. She speaks unaccented English, she isn't intimidated by coffee connoisseurs, and she understands foodie culture in the global north. Plenty of farmers have great land and great cherry, but almost none of them share Battelle's keen understanding of what her customers want to drink, what they want to hear, and what they're willing to pay. The commodity market price of coffee, known as the C, hit a modern era low of around 40 cents a pound in late 2001, just before Battelle arrived in Santa Ana. When she got there, she encountered a slew of programs designed to help producer countries capture more of coffee's value, including the Cup of Excellence competition. During the down market, nonprofits and cooperatives often made common cause with importers and roasters, all of whom wanted to keep coffee farming viable. A patchwork of certifications, such as Fair Trade and Rainforest Alliance, assured farmers higher prices in exchange for specific economic or environmental practices. Coffee inspires people to think about it while they sip, which explains why the demand for ethically farmed coffee is much higher than, say, the demand for ethically farmed sugar or bananas. At first, Battelle could afford to ignore the fluctuation of the C because her crop was worth so much more. At boutique cafes, there was no incentive to lower prices. Customers liked the idea of paying a premium for a premium cup, especially if the cup came with a story about a plucky farmer's daughter and her organic experiments. In the past decade, though, the C has climbed steadily upward, which has complicated the lives of high-end farmers and their clients. Roasters were forced to figure out whether to raise their prices, lower their standards, or swallow the difference. To buy her newest farm, Finca Tanzania, Battelle had secured a line of credit on the basis of a purchase order from Stumptown, which contracted to buy her Finca Tanzania crop for $2.50 a pound, more than a dollar over the sea. By harvest time earlier this year, the sea was heading toward $3, the highest price in decades, and Battelle found herself prepared to sell some of the world's most coveted coffee for less than the price of a generic lot. In the end, Stumptown willingly paid more. Some relationships aren't so friendly, and roasters who refuse to adjust their contracts in rising markets might find themselves confronted by shortfalls come harvest time. Now, that's technically in breach of contract, one buyer explains, but try suing 500 Mexican farmers for coffee. The rising sea has also made coffee more valuable to thieves. One day this spring, armed pickers arrived at Finca Kilimanjaro. They held the farm manager at gunpoint while they cleaned out the plants. Kilimanjaro had the highest yield this year, Battelle says, but it turned out to be the lowest because we had 2 days of nonstop theft. It was awful. No doubt her beans were blended and sold as generic high-elevation coffee. To Battelle, the thought of this adulteration is more painful than the theft. Expert coffee pickers don't pluck cherry. They spin it, separating the fruit from the stem by rotating it between the thumb and the first finger, which enables them to strip a branch quickly. In Ethiopia, farmers customarily left their cherry out in the sun, where the dry heat evaporated the moisture from the pulp, making it easy to detach seed from skin. As coffee was introduced to more humid climates, this method, known as the dry or natural method, became somewhat unreliable. Cherry that didn't dry properly might mold or rot. Now, most high-quality coffee is processed using the wet or washed method, in which cherry is skinned and pulped, put in fermentation tanks to soften the mucilage, and moved to washing tanks, where the mucilage is sloughed off. Only then are the beans set out in the sun to dry. In El Salvador, coffee farmers take their cherry to the local mill, which does all the processing, finds a buyer, and ships the unroasted beans, known as green coffee, to its clients around the world. Battelle's local mill is J. Hill, which was founded in 1896 by James Hill, a British-born coffee dealer. The company has maintained its founder's original house next to the main factory. The bedroom balcony, which overlooks the drying patios, is equipped, rather ominously, with an antiquated spotlight and loudspeaker. Battelle's beans represent less than 1% of what Jay Hill processes, but she often visits the mill, where she monitors everything from the health of her beans to the screen printing of the jute bags that they are shipped in. For Battelle, the mill is also a laboratory where she can experiment with methods from around the world. Her favorite place in the compound is the cupping room, where she can roast small samples of her coffee and judge the results. El Salvador, like many coffee-producing countries, has never really developed a coffee-drinking culture, so Jay Hill's cupping room is the closest thing in the area to a well-equipped cafe. The espresso machine is a stainless steel GS3 made by the Florence-based company La Marzocco. Its suggested retail price is $6,500. Battelle's most trusted lieutenant, Douglas Chinchilla, had run some recently roasted samples through a retail-grade Malkonig grinder, and he was apportioning the grounds into small white cups, adding precisely 12.5 grams to each. The cups were arranged around the perimeter of a circular white table that turned on a stem. Battelle spun the table, picking up each cup of dry coffee and pressing it to her face to inhale the nutty fragrance. When she was finished, Chinchilla added 250 milliliters of hot water to each cup, and he gave the coffee 4 minutes to steep. When coffee and hot water combine undisturbed, most of the grounds sink to the bottom, and a layer of foam and fine particles, known as the crust, forms on top. Battelle used her cupping spoon to break each crust. By disturbing the top layer, she released a small, scented burst, which she inhaled. Then, with a spoon in each hand, she skimmed off the crust and prepared to cup. To cup a coffee, you slurp a spoonful as quickly and loudly as possible. The idea is to pray spray coffee at all your taste buds simultaneously. Battelle slurped for a few seconds, expelled the specimen into her spit cup, rotated the table a few degrees, and began the process again. Coffee cupping was formalized in San Francisco in the late 19th century by dealers who wanted a standard way to assess and certify their product. They were looking for defects. A peanutty taste indicated the presence of beans from unripe cherry, known as Quakers. A foul, fetid taste meant that the beans had been attacked by the tenacious borer beetle. And at the high end of the coffee market, though, cuppers searched for pleasant tastes instead. Kilimanjaro has always been described as a fruit cup, Battelle said, like fruit in heavy syrup. One of the coffees on the cupping table was a new experiment, beans from Finca Kilimanjaro, processed in the Ethiopian natural style to create a more pungent flavor. She slurped and spit. There was an earthy sweetness, fading to reveal something brighter and juicier. "I'm getting chocolate-covered cherries," she said. Everyday coffee drinkers, like everyday wine drinkers, often suspect that the experts are bluffing or free associating. The industry is sensitive to this aspersion and takes pains to dispel it. At the Cup of Excellence, judges must be able to describe samples the same way when they are presented at different tables in different orders. For a novice, the cupping room can be a disorienting place. You slurp and spit, ingesting small but palpable doses of caffeine, trying to taste chocolate-covered cherries. Before long, you might start to suspect that the coffee is cupping you. With each clumsy slurp and tentative adjective, you are revealing your defects. After watching the experts grade her coffee at the Cup of Excellence in 2003, Battelle resolved to teach herself how to taste. Within a week of nonstop cupping, she was able to identify coffee's basic flavors. The skills required, sustained concentration, precise sensory awareness, and decisiveness come naturally to her. "Sometimes I think about that," she says. "Like, what if when I first started cupping, I sucked at it?" Her mastery meant that she could talk to clients about the beverage, not just the plants. In an industry where farmers and connoisseurs have often been kept apart, Battelle is both. She's a producer who speaks fluent consumer. Last year, she became the first coffee farmer to earn a certification from the Barista Guild of America. After a few rounds in the J. Hill Cupping Laboratory, Battelle agreed to go to the nearby branch of a Salvadorian chain called the Coffee Cup, which has about 24 cafes. A display near the counter was inscribed with coffee shop boilerplate in English. "After the roasting process, we sort our roasted coffee beans by hand, meticulously, to pick out only the highest quality beans." Battelle peered at a photograph of some unroasted coffee beans. "They look like they have too much humidity," she said. "They weren't dried properly." She turned to a photograph of roasted beans and pointed to a few light brown beans among the dark ones. "See? Quakers!" When her cup of Americano finally arrived, it didn't disappoint. Which is to say, it did. She slurped and swiftly wished she hadn't. "You burn me," she said. "When the top of your tongue goes numb, that's burning your taste buds. Luckily, I'm not cupping today or tomorrow." Scalding coffee is the bane of cuppers, who prefer their coffee warm, not hot, because the best coffees get sweeter and more complex as they approach room temperature. Nevertheless, Battelle managed to supply some tasting notes. "One thing I did get was a papery taste," she said. "That could be from last year's crop, or it could be coffee that wasn't stored properly." To someone who's really paying attention, coffee is a form of communication. Each cup, even a bad one, tells the story of how it got that way. When Battelle's coffee is ready to be shipped, she sometimes packs it herself, and when the last of it has been sent off to the U.S. or Norway or Japan, she follows it. Her trips north are both social visits and investigative missions. She says, "If I ever went and they were roasting the S word out of it, or blending, God forbid, my coffee, then it's over." Steve Kerbach, a roaster at Stumptown, remembers being introduced to Battelle some years ago at a Stumptown cafe in Portland. He had been roasting for only a few months, and apparently he had let a batch of Finca Kilimanjaro go too long. Roasters measure the recipe in seconds, not minutes. Battelle had examined the beans and then smiled at him and said, "Oh, you feel comfortable with this roast?" Kerbach, who is now one of Stumptown's head roasters, remembers feeling humbled and guilty. "How many days did Ada work on this project? And then I had it for, what, 14 minutes? Kerbach got a chance to redeem himself one day this summer when Battelle visited Stumptown's New York roasting facility, a cramped warehouse in Red Hook, Brooklyn. A shipment of Kilimanjaro had just arrived. He dropped 20 pounds of it into a 1950s-era drum roaster, which spun the beans and then dumped them into a cooling bed. Kerbach was concerned with temperature and momentum, the speed at which the beans were heating up, and with all the things he couldn't control, like the weather, which was hot and humid. He tried not to be distracted by the presence, a few feet away, of an extremely interested party. Stumptown came to New York 2 years ago and quickly found a market. Cafes bragged about brewing Stumptown beans, and locals proved willing to rearrange their commutes to accommodate Stumptown's Manhattan Cafe, which is inside the Ace Hotel on West 29th Street. Stumptown, with its Red Hook roasting facility, is one of a handful of small Brooklyn roasters. Cafe Grumpy, a homegrown outfit, has been roasting in Greenpoint since 2005, and Blue Bottle from Oakland arrived in Williamsburg last year. This flurry of activity marks a revival on a smaller scale of an old New York tradition. America became a nation of coffee drinkers in the 1800s, and after the Civil War, New York replaced New Orleans as the main entry point for coffee shipments. In 1881, the coffee mogul John Arbuckle built a coffee warehouse on the Brooklyn waterfront in what is now Dumbo. The Maxwell House Company, Arbuckle's great rival, built a grand Brooklyn factory in 1921, and soon after, an even grander one in Hoboken. The rise of Maxwell House was a triumph of advertising. Like most successful coffee companies, it promoted itself with vague assertions of excellence. The coffee historian Mark Pendergast views Maxwell House as an early example of the value of snob appeal, and one 1907 advertisement had a distinctly challenging tone. "Every housewife who has knowledge of coffee value will appreciate the rare quality of Maxwell House blend." Before the rise of national roasters like Maxwell House, consumers typically roasted or ruined the beans themselves or bought from local grocers. Like many other 20th century food conglomerates, the big coffee companies convinced consumers to trade freshness for consistency and convenience. Brewing habits were changing, too. Instead of boiling the grounds along with the water, a common 19th century practice, coffee drinkers wanted easier methods and better tasting coffee. Although then, as now, these two wants often conflicted. The percolator, a turn of the century invention, pushed boiling water up a stem into a separate chamber full of grounds. The mixture would steep and the coffee would drip back down into the main chamber, where it would mix back into the boiling water. The device's main asset was also its main liability. You could turn it on and forget about it. Pushing increasingly bitter and burnt liquid through an increasingly bleached bed of grounds, creating an infinitely bad cup of coffee. By the 1970s, the endless loop percolator had been displaced by the electric drip coffee maker, which was a vast improvement because water passed through the grounds only once. But in many ways, a crude technology because it offered users no way to control water temperature or steep time. Brewing a proper cup of coffee is a lot harder than uncorking a bottle of wine and a lot easier than cooking dinner. There are only two ingredients which must be combined and then separated. But somehow these variables can produce an almost limitless number of errors and misjudgments. Battelle has little patience for discussions about any apparatus more exotic than a press pot, also known as a French press, which is what she used when she was living in Nashville and still uses today. The design is nearly 100 years old and has barely changed. But an accomplished cupper like Battelle need not obsess over brewing methods because she knows what she's doing and what she's tasting, regardless of muddiness. An obsession with brewing protocol is generally the mark of an amateur, that pitiable person who makes a simple thing complicated in the futile hope of feeling kinship with the professionals. Nevertheless, if you're making coffee, you might as well make it well. Earlier this year, Stumptown accepted an investment from TSG Consumer Partners, the company that made Vitamin Water a hit. Around the time the deal was announced, Stumptown rolled out a new product, cold-brewed iced coffee, served in 10.5-ounce glass bottle called a stubby, based on an old beer bottle design. Even with new money and a new product, the company operates on a much smaller scale than Starbucks, which has been bottling Frappuccino in partnership with PepsiCo since 1996. It's hard to imagine artisanal coffee going mass market, but then, not long ago, the triumph of Starbucks, which taught Americans the meaning of latte and popularized dark roasted coffee while also requiring its customers to speak Italian, would have been pretty hard to imagine. One week in July, Battelle flew to Minneapolis to meet with some of the executives at Caribou, a coffee chain that buys Ida Battelle Selection. There are about 600 Caribou cafes, mainly in the Midwest, and the company prides itself on being smaller and friendlier than Starbucks. Battelle was accompanied by executives from Jay Hill, as well as an elegant older Salvadorian couple, producers from the ABS program. Battelle had put on a crisp white shirt, tan slacks, and leather loafers. She looked very Miami. Many of the cafes were serving an ABS coffee from a farm called El Mahayoal, which was given a brief description on one Caribou blackboard. Lighter roast, cherry, creamer, semi-sweet. Battelle didn't frown when she took her first sip, and she liked the way it sweetened as it cooled. It was tantalizingly easy. You could walk into a mall, order a small black coffee, and be handed a drink that hadn't entirely forgotten its past life as a fruit. Battelle lives in a world where exceptional coffee is the norm, but even now, amid the third wave boom, the coffee that most people drink has little in common with the beverage that Battelle loves. Could big chains and small delis produce something to her liking and do it consistently? Would their customers want them to? And if gently roasted, carefully brewed, high-elevation, single-origin coffee became the norm, would the coffee evangelists applaud, or would they find some way to call it swill? We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.